Cold Service, written by Pia Apia, read by Sweaters in the Summer. Summary: you're only as old as your minor antagonist makes you feel. Prologue: asymmetric engagement. Autumn arrived like a punishment that year, announced, impossible to duck, unhurried so as to gather up the dread. The day itself was crisp and bright enough to make one remark on how little warmth the light was giving. Yes, this also described Draco's marriage, which would be ending in about 10 minutes. September the 1st. The Hogwarts Express belched its steam. It curled around Draco and his nervous son and his tense wife, as if to provide them some final brief solitude. Alone, except when the swarm of yammering children plunged out of the mist, stinking, slamming trunks, and then back in. "I'm the only person wearing my uniform," Scorpius observed unhappily. He'd insisted on changing at home. At home, he'd feared. What if his compartment was crowded? How was he supposed to dress neatly without a mirror? In his robes, sans tie for now, of course, he looked like a fretting angel, about to get involved with a humanity that didn't deserve him.
"Maybe you wait another year," Draco said, indulging his misery.
"Hmm?
You'd be the biggest in the class and the best at magic. They'd put you on the Quidditch team straight away."
"Ignore your father," said Astoria. "He's being dramatic." Draco did not know how all the other parents here weren't lying down on the platform to sob abjectly. Most people, he supposed, were sick of their children and happy to make them go away. If he were being dramatic, he would mention that he had only ever been chaperoned to the Hogwarts Express by trembling elves, never his mother and father.
"What if I'm..."
A choppy breath. Scorpius scrubbed at a still dry eye. Draco defeated the urge to tell him not to, which would only make him start.
"What?" Scorpius looked at the ground. "If I'm not in Slytherin?"
"Darling," Astoria said.
"Darling, that doesn't matter. Draco, tell him."
"Ted, you fucking legend!"
blared a half-dropped boy voice from out of the fog.
"No, it doesn't matter," Draco said quickly. "But I don't think you have anything to worry about."
"What do you mean?"
Scorpia said, eyes huge.
"Hand on her boob!"
punctured the voice again, from a new angle, and louder.
"He means the Sorting Hat knows just what to do," Astoria said, "and puts every child in a house where they can thrive and grow."
Actually, he meant that Scorpius would certainly be sorted Slytherin, and that anyone who doubted it just because he was the sweetest and most conscientious being ever to live didn't understand cunning or the true mettle of the Malfoys. But he didn't get a chance to say so, because of the unseen pubescent predator striking ever closer.
"Swear to fuck I saw it!"
"Excuse me," Draco snarled.
"Wasn't talking to you, was I?"
said a ghastly 13-year-old as it emerged spotty face first from the mist.
"So yeah, you're excused, I reckon."
"You're in public," Draco reminded it.
"Ha ha, I'll rock your shit, you old bitch," said the creature.
Astoria's fingers closed around Draco's arm, but he had come to a halt anyway. The teenager with pimples collecting in his nose folds and a mean grin pulling one side of his mouth far enough to flash his molars also, yes, had confused black hair sticking up hideously at the back. The ego. The tone with adults. Well, obviously he was.
"Potter's kid," Draco stated.
"Yep, that's right," the demon said. "Scared now, are you?"
"Is Dad all right?"
Scorpia said. Astoria sighed.
"Yeah, sorry, mate, your dad's a bitch. Hang on, you've been crying, mate?"
"Do not talk to my son," said Draco.
"Man, these firsties. Al's gonna fit right in. Laters!"
And the thing skittered away, giggling.
Not to be dramatic, but Draco, underslept, as close to tears as he'd been in some time, his family under siege, not to be dramatic, desperate for privacy, clinging to mid-crumble structures, and being intruded on by Harry Potter. If there'd been a mirror to look in, Draco wouldn't have even had to turn around. It was quite like magic, how the mist thinned to present him some 50 yards away. Often, when Draco saw men his own age, he thought, "Merlin, fuck, that poor bastard looks old." Not Potter. It wasn't only that his was a face you saw as often as your soon-to-be ex-wife's. No gray. No middle-age spread. The body was substantial, a man's. He dressed like a member of civilized society. Had the glasses frames been updated at last?
Blink, Draco, Astoria said. He'll feel you molesting him.
He blinked. He returned. Scorpius had followed his gaze down the platform.
Remember, it's not cheating for your parents to take a look at your homework, Astoria said. All the other students will do it. No question is too small to send an owl home.
Harry Potter is looking at us, Scorpius said. He was. As if the years had robbed nothing from his life, he was still flanked by Granger, Weasley, and Weasley, and they were all looking. Steadily, without embarrassment. No need to feel caught out ever when you were them.
Gods, Draco muttered.
He sent a tight nod to the gawping crew and their mess of children.
Who's whose, I wonder? Or are they all in some kind of modern...
You'll crack a tooth, Astoria said. Could you please concentrate on seeing your only child off to Hogwarts?
Does he know you? Isn't he an Auror?
Scorpius said, worry driving his voice up and faster.
What if he thinks you did something wrong?
Don't be silly, Astoria began.
Aurors are the thugs of the ruling class, my love, Draco said, which means he works for us.
Scorpius settled. Then he smiled a little, like a shy conspirator.
He's kind of short, he said, in person.
Yes, Draco said. All celebrities are. That's all charisma really is, being short with a large head.
Scorpius frowned again.
What about our heads? We don't have charisma?
Astoria, looking at Draco, frowned also. Draco sniffed.
We have dignity.
Charisma is inherited through the mother's side, sweetheart, Astoria said.
I think it's time.
Draco passed into the miasma of Dread's fruition, where everything happened suddenly, simultaneously. His son was in a Hogwarts uniform, hanging out of an open compartment window on the train, waving sweetly now, and now inching away. Draco walked alongside, slower, then faster.
The essence of ambition is making manifest your desires, he told his son. Asking for it is proof you ought to get it. Do you follow?
No, Scorpius said, his fair eyelashes clumped with wet.
Just tell the hat to put you in Slytherin, and it will, Draco said.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, Scorpius.
There he went. Draco followed his bright hair until he was only looking at the bright day. The cold enveloped him and denuded him. He reeled. He felt like shit. A dark period was now to begin. A time of correspondence with lawyers. A time of no sex and depressing eating. His son was off. His divorce would proceed. His parents' eyes would roll back in their heads with malignant joy. The manor again a home for him and them alone. All up and down the platform went the pops of parents and guardians turning on their heels and disappearing. Perhaps thinking now to lunch, or what errands could fill out the rest of this big day. Draco despised all of them, and the one he despised most drew his eye like a carcass. Smiling in agony, near blinded by tears, Draco watched beatific Harry Potter, whose waving arm still hung in the air. Gazing down the tracks, he seemed from this distance like he could have been looking at Draco, though of course he was not. His hand drifted absently down and, so vulgar, he fingered his lightning bolt scar in plain view of the world. A painless life. All was well, Draco supposed, for him. For now.
19 years later. Very nearly. Harry Potter, who had had enough trouble for a lifetime, was having some trouble. His boss's pinched, pursed, impatient face was staring him down twofold, and he wasn't sure where to look.
"But you must have known this was coming," said Minerva McGonagall. "I turned 100 years old last term."
"Oh," Harry said, concealing, hopefully, his violent shock at that number. It was true that she had been in his life for its full duration, and had never been young. He scrutinized the painting, still unframed, on an easel beside her, so as not to scrutinize the woman. Sure, she was wrinkly. Her hair was white. He squinted at her hands, but of course a portraitist would have omitted spots and veins. The McGonagall in the portrait moved them off of her lap and out of sight. "Happy birthday," he said limply.
"Thank you, Harry," said the real McGonagall. It was in October. He'd never thought to ask, or maybe he'd been intimidated to. At any rate, he'd never really thought of McGonagall as someone who had anything as fanciful as birthdays. And if she really was retiring, he'd receive the news of hers too late to do anything with it. How soon will you go? It was a circumspect way to ask what he really wanted to, which Harry knew she knew, because her painted likeness gave him a look. He shrugged at it. She hasn't spoken yet, McGonagall said. I meant to have discussions with her and let her absorb my mannerisms and learn my life story. Who has the time? At the end of the year, to answer your question. But the end of the year's in a week! You'll have the summer to prepare. Prepare, Harry thought miserably. It was really happening. He had not been asked or invited to apply. He had been conscripted. What if I said I don't feel ready? McGonagall shot him her sternest and sharpest. You've been my deputy headmaster for 8 years, Harry. Again, I insist you must have suspected this might happen. But I'm not the most senior staff, Harry said. What about Septima? Professor Vector has never thrived when it comes to interfacing with the parents. As if I have. What about... Harry mentally ticked off the full-time professors, realizing with horror that very few outranked him in seniority or even in age. There was Professor Carmilla in astronomy, who was at least 350, but the daylight thing could pose an issue as far as day-to-day administration. Neville, he's been here longer, more than a decade longer, and he's a day older than me. Neville is already head of Gryffindor House, McGonagall reminded him. I could take Gryffindor, Harry said, and I could coach Quidditch. A snort from the wall of portraits reminded him that they were all listening, and they weren't all mute. It was true that Harry's years of excellence on the pitch were, decades behind him, but the fundamentals were the fundamentals. Quidditch instructor is not a vanity position at this school, McGonagall warned. What if Neville's headmaster, I stay deputy, and Ted's head of Gryffindor? Edward is a former Hufflepuff. But you may reorganize the staff as radically as you wish once you assume the headmastership. McGonagall gave him a long, searching look over her spectacles. They were thick, yes, an old person's glasses. Harry, I must say, I'm surprised at your reticence. Those most qualified to lead rarely seek to do so, Dumbledore's portrait said sagely, suddenly. And how does that explain your endless consolidation of power, you old coot? Said the portrait beside Dumbledore's. Snape's. Dumbledore pretended convincingly that he hadn't heard. Are you really sure you want to join them? Harry asked McGonagall. And listen to their bickering forever? You project too much onto paintings, Harry. They are both quite dead, and I will be quite far away, retired. That was right. Actually, the proposition was that it would be Harry who joined them. This term had been his last in his classroom, without his even knowing it. I like teaching, Harry said. He cut his eyes away from McGonagall, only to meet the sympathetic frown of her portrait. Deputy's been a perfect balance. A perfect balance can fall out of balance. In this case, it is balanced upon someone who is departing. You know, Minerva, I did some of my finest headmastering after 100, Dumbledore said. Harry never met me in my professional capacity until well into my 11th decade. Who could forget the astounding length of your tenure, Snape said, so sourly his canvas might have dripped bile, and that you dropped dead in office and left the rest of us to scramble. Forgive me, the details of my demise never seemed to stick, Dumbledore said. I was painted while I yet lived, of course. What was it that did me in the end? Harry caught the flap of robes slipping from Snape's frame, trounced again. Drop dead indeed, and what a drop, McGonagall said. A tasteful going-away speech will more than satisfy me. The office is ready for new blood. Harry looked up the wall of Hogwarts headmasters. Many were dozing, many were absent. Some were done in such historical styles and spoke in such antique English that meaningful chat with them was a project. They watched the room with a distant, unbothered curiosity, as one would the behaviors in a zoo. But some watched him with a political eye, an eye to the office and the school it captained. One watched him with eyes that twinkled. New blood, yeah. Had Harry really never thought that being deputy would eventually result in his becoming headmaster? Surely he had. That was practically the entire point. He tried hard to remember what he'd been feeling when he'd accepted the promotion. Sorrow and anger at Flitwick's progressing illness, and an urge to pitch in and help out. A certain tired proficiency with his curriculum, which he'd taught 9 times, thrice badly, and then 6 times well. He'd been 47, which had seemed like a regular person sort of age, far yet from a headmasterly one. He had been determined that now, then, was not the time to get scared of changing his life. He'd been separated and about to get divorced. He thought more responsibilities at work would fill in some of the yawning space and time. He thought Hogwarts was his home, and it would gather him up now. The headmaster of Hogwarts is one of the most consequential people in magical society, Harry said glumly. The entire style of witchcraft of the coming generations will be downstream of my pedagogical choices. No one in Wizarding Britain will be untouched by my influence. People will have nightmares all their lives of being sent to my office for exploding their teachers.
You've grasped it, I think, said Dumbledore.
But there is a formality before it can all be made official, said McGonagall. Your appointment must be approved by the governors of Hogwarts. In anticipation of your acceptance, I've already sent Galahad to collect the signatures.
Hogwarts still has governors?
Signatures. Harry remembered the arrogant smile of Lucius Malfoy as he unrolled a long parchment's worth of them and informed Dumbledore he was to leave.
Minerva, Harry said. I don't know anything. I don't know how to contact the governors of Hogwarts or what they do. I forgot they existed. I don't have the first clue who they are.
They are relics, McGonagall said airily, who do nothing. Family seats. They're happier being forgotten because they know the alternative is their being disbanded. McGonagall waved a hand, and the portrait of her flapped her own hand in echo. She alleged again, it's pure formality.
Have you read Hogwarts: A History?
Not in ages, said Neville.
He dipped the tines of his fork into the puddle of sauce on his empty plate and then licked.
I still never have, Harry said.
Shit.
You reckon you'll be quizzed?
Take the piss. Harry tore a tuft out of his dinner roll. He craned to spy down the high table. McGonagall was in what looked like intellectually stimulating discussion with Nemesine Spence of Ancient Ruins.
I have no idea how any of this happened to me. I don't publish. I don't invent spells. I haven't discovered 12 uses for dragon's blood. I used to be a cop.
That's not unprecedented for your role, Neville said.
Oh, though he was only pretending to be someone who used to be a cop.
I'm a fraud, Harry said.
Fraud's not unprecedented either.
You used to be very inspired by me, Harry said.
There was a time when, if I'd have said, Nev, I'm not sure I want to be headmaster, I think you should do it instead, you'd have said, thanks, Harry. Your confidence in me means the world. You're right. I'm digging deep and finding the strength, and I shall be headmaster.
And now my confidence in you will inspire you to greatness in your new leadership position, Neville said.
What parallel lives we lead, Harry. Have you ever noticed? But this time the great destiny is yours. Hey, you won't have to mark essays anymore.
Great, Harry said.
Harry had run out of dinner roll. He pushed his plate of shreds away. All day he'd been trying to understand his reaction, which was, yeah, immature. It was something like the immensity of the institution, the infinity of the building, the overwhelming prominence of Hogwarts in his own life story, the haven that took him in and gave him everything. Difficult for it to hold that tremendous shape if he had to be in charge of it. He was gathering his communication wherewithal to express this to Neville. Actually, he was finishing a big cup of meadowsweet metheglin, which was going to help with the expressing.
So who'll be your deputy? Neville asked.
Is this you submitting yourself for consideration?
Neville pulled a face. Gryffindor headmaster with a Gryffindor deputy? Wouldn't look good.
That's what McGonagall and I are.
Yeah, and does it look good?
Harry pulled at his mead while Neville peered down the high table.
What about Odalie?
Odalie Fanshawe. The extremely energetic young charms professor they'd sourced after Flitwick, who was an absolute no, which Harry was about to tell him when he saw Galahad soaring toward them, gliding silently over the heads of the students. The owl alit on McGonagall's outstretched arm.
Hmm, said Neville. Bastian?
Bastian Swallop, potions. A perfectly nice and very smart man, although a touch too obsequious towards Harry for Harry's liking. Younger profs were better about that. McGonagall was opening the letter Galahad had delivered to her. I know you'll say Teddy's out, but really, why? The nepotism allegations would be hard to beat, although Teddy was a marvelous transfiguration teacher who'd brought up the nationwide registered Animagus count by something like 900% by offering it as a course of independent study during the summer between 6th and 7th year. McGonagall frowned while she read the letter. She tucked the parchment away and then frowned more deeply and brought it back out and read it again. Glasses on, glasses off. Maybe, Harry said slowly, watching. Maybe there won't be anything to worry about. There you go, Harry, Neville said, clapping him on the back. Knew you'd find your courage.
We, the 12 undersigned governors, do accept the resignation of Minerva Fiona McGonagall from the position of headmistress of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. We, the governors, do approve and ratify the appointment of Harry James Potter, deputy headmaster and professor of defense against the dark arts, as headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, effective upon conclusion of the 2035-2036 scholastic year. The Board of Governors of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Thaddeus Gripe, Chairman. Loic Luched. Marion Ott. John Bertram Dudgeon. Cloris Unops. Hyacinthus Shrek. Chester Blandish III. Fidelity Penrose. Declan Dedalus Freak. Philippa Farrington. Cyrus Pouch. Do you see the problem? McGonagall asked, as Harry slid the parchment back over the desk. McGonagall's portrait leaned forward in her frame to get a look at it. Yeah, who on earth are these people? Harry said. The approval is incomplete, McGonagall said. Neither your appointment nor my resignation is yet official. 12 governors, Harry said, after another, longer look. There are only 11 names here. On the matter of the appointment of the headmaster, the governors must be unanimous. So what happened to the last one? It would be up to Harry, he gathered, to traipse over the countryside, locating some strange old warlock an owl could not, who didn't remember he'd been on this board for 90 years, and inform him of the current century and collect his signature. Unless... Do you think they've died? McGonagall's face was put upon in a way Harry had rarely seen during her headmistressly tenure. It made her look younger. It was the face of her years confiscating wheezes and chasing down late homework. He hasn't died, she said. He is waiting outside the office. The outer stone stairs behind him began to grind and turn. Harry turned too, and watched as they admitted a guest. What he saw first was the hair, still towish white gold, as no grown man's could remain in a mundane world. A beautiful blue traveling cloak, lightweight for late spring. Fine leather shoes. A long, cunning face starring a ghastly society smile. And the eyes, that unnerving, watery gray. Harry was a man of a certain age, and an experienced teacher. He was not any longer hot-headed. He had gray-rocked the chroniclers of a celebrity until they'd withered away from neglect. He had withstood legal threats and physical threats from parents of A and P students, and given the earned and deserved A's and P's. He had executed a divorce so amicable that his children were currently well-adjusted adults. So, although, yes, it was telegraphed well loudly from his little smile and his little entrance that he was here to be a shameless pain in the arse, Harry greeted Draco Malfoy by standing up and shaking his hand and saying, "Draco, how do you do?"
"Professor Potter," in that plummy voice, that drawl that flirted always with a whine, grown a little gravelier with the years.
"Harry."
"Harry," Draco Malfoy said with bureaucratic ice. "I've been better, I'm afraid."
He turned his attention to McGonagall and gestured for her to retake her seat, and conjured one of his own next to Harry's, an extravagance of green leather dotted with silver nailhead trim.
"I was sorry to receive word of your resignation, headmistress. Pax McGonagalla has been a tremendous era for Hogwarts."
McGonagall's expression was admirably unreadable, but her disdain showed plainly on the portrait beside her.
"Yes, well," she said,
All eras meet their natural ends. I'm lucky that mine should be of my own volition, on my own terms.
And I was lucky not only to govern the school under your headmistresship, but to enroll my son at Hogwarts during your tenure, Malfoy preened. You remember Scorpius?
Of course, said Harry, who would not be shut out. One of my very first students here. He's the same age as one of my kids, you know.
Malfoy paid him complete silence.
Mr. Malfoy, McGonagall said, I'm gratified that you think so highly of my leadership. But as you are aware, my tenure cannot conclude, nor my successor succeed me, without the approval of the 12 governors of Hogwarts. Approval which you personally seem to have withheld.
Malfoy uncrossed and recrossed his legs.
Compendious as always, headmistress. That is indeed the reason for my call today. You see, the governors have some concerns.
And with silken sick fuck relish.
About your proposed successor.
Really? Harry said. I see 11 unconcerned names on this parchment.
It's not that we don't, of course, recognize Professor Potter's quite singular effort, Malfoy continued, for the wizarding world. But we find ourselves questioning the relevance of his titanic, to be sure, achievement to the academic life, if I may speak plainly.
One wishes, Harry said.
Professor Potter vanquished a Dark Lord, and not many of us can say that. Though, of course,
Malfoy gestured with a bony hand to Dumbledore, who was sleeping extremely unconvincingly,
there are others who have held the office who can. And when compared with them, or with the majority of professors at this institution, Professor Potter's curriculum vitae is notably light.
Hang on!
One expects to see, perhaps, some scholarly engagement with the field, a publication now and again.
I was a Ministry of Magic's head auror from age 25.
And if the position needing filling were chief of security...
Listen, slimeball, Harry said, twisting in his chair to get in Malfoy's face. I don't know, nor do I care, what the hell you've been doing with your time, but I've worked here for nearly 20 years. I'm a great educator, and I love this school, and every morning I wake up to put in another day teaching kids about the miracle of magic and how to use it to build beautiful lives and be helpful to one another, unlike you or any other governor or trustee or other total parasite who just sits on boards and decides whether or not to sign off on decisions other people take care in making. Wildly, Harry cast an eye toward McGonagall to gauge how badly he was fucking it. Wincing, strained, her and the portrait both, nothing for it. And how the bloody hell did you get on the board anyway? Wasn't your father sacked after he was embarrassed by unfortunate political associations? Couldn't just crawl away and expire with dignity, could you? You have to enjoy influence, like all creepy rich fucks. Just where the fuck do you get off, Malfoy? What have you published in the last 18 years apart from whatever just following orders apology I've thankfully missed whilst completely fucking forgetting about you? How about publishing your fucking tax returns? Harry fell silent. Everyone was silent. Dumbledore let out a soft, fake snore.
Well, Malfoy said, folding his hands one atop the other in his lap. You can see why we hesitate.
Well,
enough, said McGonagall in her normal voice, yet slightly quiet and slightly stilted, and from slightly to her left.
The portrait had uttered its first word.
Quite right, said the real McGonagall, with obvious pleasure at this milestone for her lightness. Mr. Malfoy, you will allow that there is more to the teaching of young people than acceptances and abjuration quarterly. I think you might best assuage your concerns by spending some time at the school you govern. You could conduct interviews of Professor Potter's students and our staff. Of course, it would take several days for you to be thorough. But thoroughness is required, wouldn't you agree, to come to a truly considered decision?
Slick Minnie. Harry was torn. On the one hand, Malfoy humiliated and put in his place for this embarrassing display. On the other hand, Malfoy hanging around.
I don't have several days to spend at Hogwarts, Malfoy sneered.
Enough, the portrait said again. She's right again, said McGonagall with an approving nod.
On the contrary, there is a full week left in the school year. I doubt you'll even need the whole time.
unless this meeting has already dispelled your worries?
Harry felt a powerful urge to smirk at Malfoy, who had been cornered into petulant, frustrated silence, but McGonagall's portrait signaled to him with a minute shake of the head.
As far as your interviews, McGonagall said, why don't you start with me? Professor Potter, if you'll excuse us.
Reluctantly, Harry rose. As he waited for the stone stairs to cycle him down and away, he enjoyed the sight of the back of Malfoy's head, and beyond it, McGonagall's grinning portrait. And beyond that, Dumbledore rubbing at his eyes with a theatrical yawn, deigning at last to wake and participate.
He's such a fucker, Harry said. Did I say that already?
Yeah, Neville said. But I don't disagree. Well, they were a bit stoned. The school day was over. The year nearly over. Neville's private stash would be stale by September, so it was incumbent on them to smoke down what they could of what remained. The wet heat of Greenhouse 5 was making Harry feel lizardly, draped over an old stone bench to cool himself. Neville was harvesting the last of the flying thyme with great arcing swipes of his butterfly net.
"Dunno what his problem is," Harry said.
"You," Neville said. "Same as it's always been."
Harry stared at the drippy ceiling.
What did I ever do to him?
Neville said.
We did him a favor. He wouldn't have had a happy time in the Voldemort century.
Helping someone doesn't always make a friend of them. People don't like to feel indebted.
But all this effort, Harry said. After all this time, why didn't he just do nothing?
Harry, no offense, Neville said, plucking still flapping leaves from a sprig.
But isn't this what you hoped for? That something would prevent your becoming headmaster?
No.
Harry knew that wasn't quite honest. Up until the moment Draco Malfoy had expressed his concerns, Harry had basically shared them, that he wasn't qualified, that the legacy was too overwhelming. But now those fears felt embarrassing to admit to. Or rather, it felt embarrassing to admit to being governed by fears.
Let me ask you something, Nev, Harry said. Do you think you've become less brave as you've got older?
Neville put aside his butterfly net.
Let me have another hit so I can proper contemplate.
Harry handed him the joint. He could anticipate a prevaricating sort of answer along the lines of, but there are many different kinds of bravery, where being honest with himself about being scared of responsibility was actually equally as brave as fighting a big snake with a sword. Harry felt a certain frustration with the blanket of self-exoneration that he could picture, quiet emotional bravery, draping over absolutely everything. Sometimes you really had no choice. Fear of aging, fear of dying. It wasn't like bravery was required to nonetheless get old and die. All you had to do was nothing. Sometimes it was very easy to do nothing. You could go years doing nothing.
Let me ask you something else, Nev, Harry said. Is it wrong to get used to life?
Nev, echoed in a dopey tone, do you ever wonder if the color red I see is the same color red that you see?
Draco Malfoy, kicking at the vines that inched to greet him, was in the greenhouse.
Fuck me, where'd you come from? Neville asked, biting down on a cough.
Harry had not heard the door to the greenhouse swinging open, nor, indeed, had he spotted Malfoy's approach through the 360 degrees of glass separating them from the grounds of Hogwarts. Then again, he was a bit stoned.
"Oh, I bloody hate hippies," Malfoy said, waving his hand obnoxiously to clear away imagined smoke.
"You can literally just legitimize someone and find out."
"What?" Harry said.
Malfoy swept imagined dirt from his sleeve with a silver-ringed hand.
"You did bounce arse first off one hard truth, though. Bravery, otherwise known as recklessness, is a trait natural only to children and intellectual children."
He gestured to Harry, still sprawled on his bench.
"That is why they send teenagers to die in wars."
"How long you've been listening to us," Neville squeezed out, taking another toke.
"I completely disagree," Harry said. "There are many different kinds of bravery."
"Harry," Neville said, "I just got chills."
"What?"
"That's what Dumbledore said."
Neville clutched at his heart. A sprig of thyme flew away.
"Almost exactly. There are all kinds of courage. I, therefore, award 10 points to Mr. Neville Longbottom."
Fuck, I might cry. Jot that down, Malfoy.
Say, Longbottom, said Malfoy. You're a decorated herbologist. I'll bet everything in here is your own cultivar.
Well, yeah, Neville said. It says Greenhouse 5 Special Cultivars on the door.
And you're a head of house?
And I killed Nagini, Neville said.
And yet somehow it's not you who gets tapped for headmaster. Doesn't it frustrate you to live in the Chosen One's shadow life?
Give me a million galleons, Neville said.
If you're opening salary negotiations.
No, I just think it's the only thing anybody should ever say to you. I want a million galleons. Malfoy scowled.
I'm here to interview you, Longbottom, about Potter's fitness for the headmaster position. It's at his peril if you won't take it seriously.
Oh, all right, Neville sighed, peeling off his gardening gloves. But I should mention I'm very high.
Rest assured, it will be officially noted, Malfoy said.
At length, Harry realized that they were going and that he, Stone, was being left here under the hot glass. He could see sweat at the temple of Malfoy's turning away face. What a strange man Malfoy was, carrying out this task he didn't want to do, that McGonagall had passive-aggressively invented for him. Harry wondered if he'd heard the part where Neville had asked whether this wasn't what Harry had wanted. Malfoy, Harry said, be honest for a second. Why are you doing all of this? Really?
Because I don't fucking like you, Malfoy said at once, and went out.
I solemnly swear that I am up to no good, Harry whispered, and broke one of his most sacred self-imposed rules. The Marauder's map held far too much information for a teacher to possess about the curfew breaks and class skips of a healthy student body. It really was no good for him to be looking. He had never even been tempted until now. Draco Malfoy was not in the guest quarters he'd been given, and he wasn't in conference with McGonagall or Neville or any other prof Harry could spot. He was in the defense room with Harry Potter. Harry slapped two palms over the map and looked up. What the fuck are you doing here? Malfoy, sitting in the last row, had an elbow on his desk and his pointed chin in his hand.
Profanity in the classroom. You are such a cool teacher, Professor Potter. I'm observing your class, unless that's a problem.
Harry, who had been planning on giving everyone quiet revision time today, sent a tight smile back. Absolutely fine by me. He flicked his wand to the door, which swung open. Under the cover of the second-year Hufflepuffs trundling in, he muttered, Mischief managed, as close to silently as he could, and stowed the map. How long had Malfoy been hiding in here? And where? Pair up, my puffs, Harry said. Ignore that disturbing man. Let's see how ice-cold we can get our disarming spells in 1 hour. Then the room was alive with cries of Expelliarmus and the clatter of wands on hardwood. He gave it 30 minutes and then hopped on his broom and made himself a moving target for them, zipping overhead, waving his wand about. They mostly missed, even 20-on-1, but now and then it was tugged from his grip. 5 points to Hufflepuff, Miss Reddy, Harry crowed, diving to scoop his wand back up from between desks. That got the fire coming twice as thick. Hufflepuff was neck and neck with Gryffindor in house points, with a week left to take the cup. He awarded 15 more before the hour was out, and landed with his skin all over prickling from the onslaught. Right, no surprises on the exam. If you want to use the classroom for practice between now and then, be my guest, just put some pillows down. He trailed off at the raised hand in the back. Yes?
Professor Potter, came Malfoy's surly voice. As much fun as we're all having, I must admit I'm surprised you aren't more vigilant about being disarmed, considering your stewardship of the Elder Wand.
Harry guffawed.
Governor Malfoy, I've been disarmed hundreds of times by dozens of students. I've taught this course for 18 years. If the Elder Wand's not mine anymore, fuck if I know whose it is.
The students predictably giggled at the swearing. Malfoy's sneer developed enough to flash a tooth. From all the way at the front of the class, Harry could see the bunching of Malfoy's jaw. Harry watched him rise. To the students, at least, where this was going was very obvious. They cleared to the sides of the room gleefully. I think your son even got me once, Harry said, just to push him.
Mention my son again, Malfoy said.
Do you want to have a go?
I'm only here to observe your charmingly unstructured teaching, Professor.
It's a hands-on class, Governor. Unless... Harry smiled and set his broom down with a vibrating hand. You're scared?
You wish,
Malfoy said instantly. Harry's chin jutted out as he bowed, as if daring Malfoy to deck him. His big smile erupted into a crazed laugh, and then another, and he doubled over, and the silver flash of spellwork cleared, and he realized Malfoy had hit him square with a tickling charm. You bloody... Harry wheezed, slumping over. Cheater! Oh, fuck! Tarantalegra! Malfoy lurched sideways into several huddled Hufflepuffs, who squealed and shoved him back to the center of the room. He fired something nonverbal at Harry, which missed him on account of how they were both wildly convulsing, and cracked Harry's blackboard in half behind him.
Finite incantatum,
they both yelled, jabbing at themselves. Then there was stillness, apart from the chalk dust settling over everything, and silence punctuated by their gasps. Harry stood up, shoving at his glasses where they'd slipped. He suppressed another laugh, a real one now. What a stupid duel. How familiar.
Serpent Sorcia,
Harry said, ignoring the shrieks of his students. A long black snake dumped itself out of his wand, rearing its arrow head, flicking its black tongue. Don't bite, Harry told it. He could feel the smile on his face. He supposed he looked quite mad. Just get close. He knows it's his game. He remembers. He tore his eyes from the snake and found Malfoy watching him. He's run out of script, Harry hissed. The sibilance poured out as if he spoke this tongue every day. Let's see what he'll do now.
Sectum Sempra, Malfoy spat.
Thud. The snake's head hit the floor. The body followed, tumbling limp and heavy as rope. Harry looked at the animal, neatly lopped. No blood, it was only magic. He knew the move left to him in the old dance. Malfoy's twisting, red, wet face, getting halfway through the word. Harry bent. I concede, he said, and placed his wand on the ground. Harry ate well that night. Roast leg of lamb, rare enough to blush. Peas and crisp asparagus. Treacle tart, oh, his favorite. Second helping. He felt the gossip coursing down the long tables. That man! Professor Potter dueled with that man! Yes, in class! They seemed to know each other. They seemed to really hate each other. Was Professor Potter very angry? He was grinning like a maniac. He spoke like a snake. Yeah, hissing. I'd forgotten he could do that. Harry's fifth years were bouncing off the walls. They'd already sat their OWLs. Normally, he'd have just let them go outside. We have a visitor, Harry said, indicating Malfoy, who again sat in the back of the room. A shudder of excitement went through the students, whose heads were swiveling to look between Malfoy and their teacher, wondering if there would be another duel, and over what, and who would start it. I think we should show him our Patronus charms, Harry said. The students groaned and grouped up. Harry knew they were probably sick by this point of Patronus, which was not even on the OWL they'd just taken. But Harry wasn't sick of it. Harry's partiality for the Patronus charm was famous. It had been famous at the DMLE. It was essential for us during the war, he'd said to his first recruits as head auror, who were just old enough to have been tiny at Hogwarts while he was its main character. They got younger after that, old enough to have an older sibling who'd spectated him in a Quidditch game, then old enough to have strong memories of the face, undesirable number one, on posters everywhere during the war, then old enough only to have parents who revered him and were proud of them for making his team. Then he retired the war line, but he taught all of them the Patronus. He'd learned to clock the look of someone who thought they couldn't do it, the look Malfoy had now, sitting in the back of Harry's fifth-year class in 2036. It was a hard and soft look, while they picked over their memories for the 100th time, all the happy ones now stained by their failed stress test as Patronus fuel. Happy, but as it turned out, not happy enough, so not so happy. It was a compounding problem. Someone who'd worked their Patronus casting too hard had mental rivulets, deepening all the time, between all their childhood joys and the last disappointing run at a Patronus they'd tried to harness them for. Being very happy was hard to conjure. Remembering a happier time, what could be sadder than that? Happiness from long ago was so delicate it couldn't take exposure to the air of the present. Remember when you were happy because you were too stupid to understand that you weren't? Remember when you were happy because something bad hadn't happened to you yet? Remember when you were happy because you had something you don't have anymore? Never let it be said that Harry of James Sirius, Albus Severus, and Lily Luna, was a man who could resist sentimental remembering. He loved to get in his cups and have a good cry remembering with his old friends. He loved to cast exactly how wonderful dead Remus had taught him to. But at the DMLE, watching the shifty eyes of someone who thought they were going to wash out of the academy with an unperformed Patronus, Harry decided to pivot away from the past. Fantasy was hit or miss. Sometimes a beautiful future could be imagined and tasted. Picture yourself having already done this thing you were certainly about to accomplish. What are you doing? Eating a perfect meal. Having perfect sex. You're on a beach. You're in a cloud forest. Who's there? They love you. Feel sunlight touch your face. Now cast. For this method, you had to get the charm out before fear arrived. It had to be only worry. What if we don't make it out? We will. Expecto Patronum. Once it was real fear, I think I'm going to die, certainty that you were going to live wasn't, for most people, any longer conjurable. Aurors worked in pairs, famously. That was the first version of the idea. Just pair people who couldn't produce one with people who could, and the Patronus would cover both. Then he'd thought, what would stop it then from being both their Patronus in that crisis moment, if it lived to protect them both? Guess who'd showed him? A random surly kid named Tristan, whom they wouldn't have taken in a stronger year of applicants. Swarmed with Dementors, his partner Jewel's soul halfway out of her mouth, had taken her limp hand and cast with her wand and conjured her Patronus, a jackdaw. She'd sent it out for me so many times, he'd put in his report. I knew it was in there when I needed it for her. Trust. That was the new faith, the new old joy. Why don't we cast in groups more often? Harry had asked Hermione, astonished at how well it was working. How much time have you got? She answered. One wizard, one wand. Toxic individualism. You need to write a paper, Harry. He had not. He'd been busy. To make a long story short, too late, if a whole class of 15-year-olds held hands on the first day of class and produced one Professor Harry J. Potter's stag Patronus together, by the end of the year, they all had perfect trust that a Patronus would be leaping out of their wand. Their friends, maybe, if they were feeling horrible that day, or if they hadn't ever got their own out yet. You could call it a misery-shared, misery-halved principle. You could call it a menagerie, the flash and shimmer of animals galloping and undulating through his classroom, Harry's own stag among them. It followed him to Malfoy's desk in the back.
"Do you really give points," Malfoy said, eyeing it, "for a child conjuring your Patronus?"
"Of course," Harry said. "If they conjure it, it's theirs." Malfoy watched the stag, who tossed its head.
"And if it mowed me down on a Quidditch pitch, does that mean it's mine too?"
Pleasure at someone's expense, Harry had always coached, was bad fuel, no matter how much they deserved what befell them. The Patronus wouldn't come out strong that way. Malfoy, in a heap of spooky black robes with his cronies. It wasn't the memory that was sweet, but the fact of it, given back to him by such a funny, unexpected guardian. "I remember your son's Patronus," Harry said. I'd got pretty good by his fifth year at getting them out of the kids. He was nervous and not a big talker, so I thought his would be one of the last. But it was one of the very first, which meant the other students used it. We had it round all year. A wyvern. It was his memory, but he watched it light Malfoy up. Harry held his hand out. What would Malfoy's be? Three guesses and the first two don't count. Do you want to have a go? Fox, dragon, scorpion. Malfoy's eyes slid from the stag's antlers to Harry's palm. He smiled slowly. You wish. You wish. Every time he looked away from the map, Draco Malfoy moved. Busy for a man pursuing total horseshit. At this rate, everyone at the school would know Harry was up for the headmastership. Maybe that was the play. That everyone should know, and that he should be rejected. Harry went to the library. He looked up the Board of Governors in the Index of Hogwarts of History. The appointment and suspension of the head of Hogwarts School is decided by the governors. Okay. He looked up the Malfoys in the Invisofiche. Donation, donation, foundation, foundation. Astoria out of the picture by 2018. Lucius still alive. Narcissus still alive. Scorpius had been friends with Al a decade and a half ago. Harry had no idea if Draco Malfoy had ever met his son. It had to be a scorpion, didn't it? Draco Malfoy sailing all over the castle. He was an animagus, of course, sneaking under closed doors, popping up. Scorpion, squirrel, ferret would be funny. Harry slept badly. He was rapidly becoming obsessed. It was Thursday, one day until the leaving feast. Then the term would be over. Harry's only class that day was with the seventh years, who'd already sat their NEWTs, and spent the hour showing off their warding for him, putting him inside so many concentric circles of protection that he couldn't even pluck a hair from his own head, and then taking them all down and crying about leaving Hogwarts. It was still morning when they slouched out of the classroom, wiping their eyes and clutching each other. Then Harry went to the map. Malfoy was on the grounds, near the Whomping Willow. Harry rushed to the edge of the classroom, flattened himself against the window. When he opened it and leaned out, he could just see the willow. He squinted, but there was no one there. He looked again at the map. Draco Malfoy. Caught. Animagus, for sure. Something too small for Harry to see from the third floor. He bolted into the corridor. But when he scrambled down over the grounds, the man was there. He wore his lightweight traveling cloak. It was warm out, and very sunny. "Hey!" Harry hurled. Malfoy turned, as if he hadn't been waiting for Harry's arrival. Malfoy's eyes looked so clear in the bright day. His eyelashes were blonde, which had always given him a surly, tired look, like a young child just roused from a nap and deciding whether to have a strop. He didn't have any gray hair, unlike Harry, who no longer had any black.
"I'm following up on a disturbing anecdote," Malfoy said, "regarding your lasting impact on the school. This heritage specimen still carries scars from damage done to it when you... What was it?"
"Ron and I crashed a car into it," Harry said impatiently. The Whomping Willow stretched out its branches dramatically. You'd really have to be looking for it. But yeah, its left hook was still a little wimpier than its right. "Have you visited the trophy room?" Harry asked. "Special services to the school, 1992, 1993, 1998, of course. Won the Quidditch Cup at least once. Remind me, did you ever... Never mind, I don't care. Term's over, Malfoy."
"So?" Malfoy said. "The search for a new headmaster could go on all summer if necessary."
The Whomping Willow creaked. Harry sympathized. He was the closest he'd been in decades to throwing a punch. "Well, you haven't interviewed me," he said, unfisting his hands and crossing his arms. "Go on, then. Ask me how I propose to close the cultural knowledge gap between Muggleborns and the rest of the first years without making them feel like they've been singled out for remedial work. Ask me if I'm ambivalent on sorting. Ask me if I think we need art and drama and language classes and a student newspaper and where I plan to find the money. Speaking of, ask where I plan to find subsidies for buying wands so every student can start with a new one that chose them. Oh, ask me if I think Hogwarts should be completely free to attend, by the way."
"How many NEWTs did you earn?" Malfoy asked.
"Zero. Didn't finish school."
"Why did you leave the Aurors?"
"My son came home from his first year and asked me whether it was true that Aurors were the thugs of the ruling class." Malfoy was starting to look awfully smug.
"Why did you and your wife divorce?"
"Because I'm gay," Harry said. "Ask a real question."
"These aren't real questions."
"Are you a serious person at all?" Harry asked. "Do you only exist to be a pain in my arse?"
"I don't know," Malfoy said. "How's your arse?"
"Why are you so fixated on me?"
"I wouldn't call it fixated," Malfoy said coolly. "I don't, for example, track your every movement on an enchanted map so I can follow you around when you're trying to be alone."
"I don't think you know the meaning of the word alone," Harry returned. "I think that without me to antagonize, your life has no purpose. I think this is the most you've done with your time in 20 years. I think whether or not you held my hand, your Patronus would be the same, and it would be mine." Harry's chest rose and fell. They were standing close enough that the millimeters made a difference. Malfoy was looking down his nose, which was going pink in the sun. His neck, too, pinking. Malfoy didn't move so quickly that Harry couldn't have done something. Harry thought he might get hit, or hauled in and kissed, and he held still to allow either one to land. But Malfoy took Harry's hand and folded it over his own,
on the wand he'd had much, much longer than the one Harry had taken away from him, and cast the Patronus charm. It felt funny, always giving someone an assist. A gentle draining of something you hadn't noticed was full. A feeling, actually, of relief. What resolved between them was small. Small enough to fit between them. It looked more elegant in shimmering blue-white than it would have in life. It struck quick at Harry's chest and plunged right through. All he felt was cool, sweet light. What was the score? What was the game? Harry had retreated to his office and had begun word salad rehearsals on breaking it to McGonagall that she'd need to submit a new name. The map was still open, of course. He never closed it. Malfoy was on the move. He was flying up the stairs, all the way up to the 7th floor, where there weren't any teachers for him to interrogate. He was going to Gryffindor Tower, maybe, to see what the students would say about Harry, or asking portraits for gossip. He was veering to the left. He'd stopped. He was pacing thrice back and forth.
"Students are advised not to enter the door that may appear to them if they concentrate on an urgent need across from the tapestry of Barnabas the Barmy on the 7th floor. The room behind it is actively on fire."
McGonagall had said that at every start of term feast for the last 38 years, to the same big, nervous laugh from kids who thought she was joking and kids who knew she wasn't. Harry was 4 floors away. He got up to run and plowed right into Malfoy. "What?" he said, having fallen on his arse. Barnabas's trolls were hitting their peak turns. He was outside the room of requirement. Malfoy sprawled beside him. "Don't," Harry croaked. "Don't go in there. The fiendfire's still burning." Malfoy put the back of his hand on the door and jerked it back. "It wants more air and more fuel, so it gets it," Harry said. "So it keeps raging."
"My lasting impact on the school," Malfoy said with a tight cheerfulness.
Harry remembered his face, ash-smeared, tear-smeared, as they drug themselves off the floor right here, retching and coughing, alive. "There's only one way to salvage your legacy," Harry said. "Approve me as a new headmaster."
"How do you think you apparated, arsehole?"
Malfoy was pulling a roll of parchment out of his lightweight cloak's inner pocket and unrolling it.
"You really know nothing. A dark age is about to begin for magical education."
"We, the 12 undersigned governors, do accept the resignation of Minerva Fiona McGonagall from the position of headmistress of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. We, the governors, do approve and ratify the appointment of Harry James Potter, deputy headmaster and professor of defense against the dark arts, as headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, effective upon conclusion of the 2035-2036 scholastic year. The Board of Governors of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry: Thaddeus Gripe, chairman; Loic Luched; Marion Ott; John Bertram Dudgeon; Cloris Unops; Hyacinthus Shrek; Chester Blandish III; Fidelity Penrose; Declan Dedalus Freke; Philippa Farrington; Cyrus Pouch; Draco L. Malfoy.
"Oh, good," Harry said. "So the matter's concluded," and kissed him. They weren't young. Kissing in a heap on a corridor floor was embarrassing and it hurt their knees, so it didn't go on. Harry got up first and held his hand out and felt a perfect triumph when Malfoy took it.
"Now enough of these nostalgia tableaux," Malfoy said, standing,
his hand still in Harry's.
"Show me something new."
Black and yellow all around them in the great hall. The Badgers had taken the house cup. Teddy, down the other end of the high table, was drunk. Neville was complaining in Harry's ear. "McGonagall's last leaving feast ever, Harry. You couldn't have done your part for a Gryffindor win?" Harry might have remarked on how it always seemed like a Gryffindor win was the only suitable ending to the year's narrative, except that he was more interested in the live bird that had somehow found its way into the Great Hall. It was high up in the rafters, sitting atop a Hufflepuff banner, and it had its eye on Harry. Small, normal, brown with a white chest. A lark. It lifted off and took a pass around the long room. Harry had not practiced his tasteful going-away speech in honor of Professor McGonagall as much as he would have liked. He had had a distracted end of term. But it covered what it needed to.
the destroyed castle and debased institution she had inherited, her tireless efforts to repair, the receipt of his own Hogwarts letter, signed by the deputy headmistress, her, his stupefied honor at becoming her colleague and now her successor, the very bigness of the to fill shoes. Harry rose from his seat at the high table and looked out at the great hall with its flushed, raucous, happy, exhausted students, and prepared to address his school for the first time. A wet impact hit his shoulder. Lark shit. "Oh, well done, Harry," said Neville. "Very good luck, that is." Epilogue. Acts of Service. All was on the way to well at the Black family townhouse in Islington, which Potter had turned out to own. He had never lived there, he'd explained to Draco, because he found it depressing and overburdened with memory. He and his family had made their life in a sweet, sun-filled cottage in Godric's Hollow, a village with a statue of Potter's dead parents, where Potter indulged his addiction to sentiment and named all of his children after dead parental figures, plus Snape and his weird friend. By the time his marriage had fallen apart, he'd been living most of the time at Hogwarts anyway, so he had simply topped up that to all the time. Draco, however, had no desire to live in a boarding school, even in the headmaster's quarters. He would have been content enough at the manor, which had been witness to plenty of gay sex before, during, and after his marriage to Astoria, although perhaps never, actually, with a man his own age. Regardless, Potter objected. So while Potter prepared for September, Draco prepared number 12 Grimmauld Place. The project was two-pronged. The first step was to gain the adoration of the house. This was not difficult, because it had gone unloved for so long. Draco did a little cleaning and hosted a few guests, and soon enough, the vases were refilling themselves with redolent flowers, and the phonographs were piping Celestina, and the soft scrambled eggs were turning out really nice every time. The second step was to establish, with his solicitors, the rightful line of inheritance. Here was where Draco anticipated being misinterpreted. He would only take ownership of the townhouse from Potter and his dim adult children if Potter didn't fight him for it. And there was no question that Potter would fight him for it. Yes, he was, and would be very busy with his first year as Hogwarts headmaster, but a little litigation kept the blood flowing. So when Draco received an owl one hot evening in August that the transfer of ownership was complete, he hesitated not at all before sending it back out with a message for Harry Potter. Draco Malfoy lives at number 12 Grimmauld Place. It would be very wrong, after all, to let him get used to life.